Accession number 27244, Mr. John Lincoln, Reel 6. Now, part of this, it's a bit difficult to chart our way through the next period, but you were air portable, weren't you? Can you talk a bit about that whole thing?
Well, we had a central airfield at a place called Manfi, which was quite a few miles inland.
And how's that spelled?
M-A-F-I-E. And there we had a squadron from the southern counties of twin Pioneer short takeoff aircraft. Now, these aircraft are ideally suited for jungle and short man-made airstrips.
Do you know what type they were? Osters?
What? I've no idea. Well, they were twin Pioneers.
Twin Pioneer.
They're quite famous. There's one in the museum, which I stumbled across here. There's an air museum down in the East Lothian. And lo and behold, he was on. And I hadn't seen one since those days in West Africa. But they are known as the Twin Pioneer short takeoff aircraft. They have a payload of about 1,600 pounds. And they carry sort of four or five people, pilot and pilot and navigator. And they can take off in a very short space and land in a very short space. So they're ideal for the jungle airfields. And these were the things we used to travel backwards and forwards around the Cameroon. In fact, there was a relay of these used to go out to Kano in Nigeria, which was where the main military depot was of the West African Frontier Force, where they used to supply us from there with certain items. So it was a regular service. And of course, if you used these, they tried to give as many people the safety training, so you were taught how to come down in a parachute in case they had to chuck you out over the jungle because they couldn't land in case of emergency.
Now, you hadn't had full parachute training, but this was...
No.
Tell me how they taught you then.
Well, they had to did a balloon, a balloon and basket, and you were taught, you did 60 cents from balloon and basket. And then you were then considered capable of using a military parachute to get down in case you needed to.
Now, had they given you when they do it in England or in a proper parachute school, they give you lots of training on how to land and all the rest of it.
Well, you got a bit of that, but it wasn't really necessary. I mean, if you go to a civilian parachute training school, they teach you how to land, how to roll, and it's all done in a static position. There's none of all the fancy stuff they have the airborne boys. I mean, they of course have to do they have to be able to fight when they're coming down, if necessary. They're airborne infantry, whereas the guys that use a parachute, in this case, it was purely as a safety device to get you down because you were air portable. If you see what I mean.
So, was it more a safety device if the aircraft was going to crash, or was it a way of landing?
Well, it could be used as a way of landing, let's put it that way, if necessary. But you didn't do the extensive training that the parachute regiment does.
Now, what do you remember of your first jump? Cause people
terrified. There were teeth marks on the edge of the basket. Because he taps you on the shoulder and says, go, and say, do I have to? He said, yes, you have to. And gives you a quick shove and out you go, you know.
Give us a picture of it.
It's hard to explain. It's like you know how to land. You know how to put your feet together, brace the knee, brace and relax the knees, posture the body, and you hit the ground and you roll, right? You hit and collapse and roll. Because when you come down, it's like jumping off a 6-foot wall. That's the only way I can describe it. The jar to your body is like a 6-foot wall. And when you jump off a 6-foot wall, right?
So not excessive, then?
It's not excessive, no, because you're not that far up. I mean, 800,000 feet, so all this basket goes to. I mean, and you're on a static line.
800 to 1,000,
not Yeah, 800 to 1,000 feet, you're up.
Now, where was that done? Was that done out in Africa, or was that done...
No, in Africa, in Manfi, at the RAF place.
And how was your first job? I mean, some people enjoy it, once they're out. Some people don't.
Well, I'm terrible on heights. I get terribly dizzy on top of a ladder. And yet I didn't feel that up there. That wasn't the effect that it had. I don't mind flying at all. I'll fly as much as you like. And yet I'm terrible on a ladder. Queer, isn't it? But no, it was quite an experience. As I say, there was four of us went at a time, you know, with the instructor, and you'd gone through all how to put it on, how to tighten all the straps and all the rest of it, and the effects of the wind, etc., 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 and how to pull down on your lifts to move the parachute from side to side, and so on. And you just did your first drop, and then for the rest of that week. Sort of did one drop a day until you'd done the required six, and you'd be completely competent then to use a parachute.
And did you get less nervous each time?
Yeah, you did. You couldn't wait to get back up. stupid feeling. Think, wait, let's go again, you know.
But you didn't jump from an aeroplane?
No.
Now, so you got this parachute training, and then what was it like travelling in these Twin Pioneers? I mean, they're not big aircraft, are they?
They're not big, and you have sort of little bucket seats. You sit with your backs to the fuselage, so up the sides, three people on either side with a cargo down the middle. I mean, we used to put all our mobile dental kit and that in there, and we'd sit on either side of it. And you've got a door out towards the tail. And quite often that was left open, and you had the navigator crewman, he'd be backwards and forwards, up and down the fuselage, and talking to you and looking out and so on and so forth. And I mean, you fly over the jungle, and it's quite a wonderful sight from up there, because there's huge lakes in the African jungle. You never see them from the ground unless you're actually upon them, but there's several of them, and most of them are volcanic. So you look down, and you're looking down at the core of a volcano. So as you fly over, you look down, and you're looking right down into the centre of the core of the volcano with the water around it, you know. So in other words, the flooded volcanoes, and not lakes at all. But they're all quite small lakes, you know. There's the huge lakes, of course, in Central Africa, Lake Victoria and so forth. But these are little lakes, actually, in the jungle.
And how far would you be flying?
Well, we'd fly...
Where would you be going?
Right, well, we would have to go... There was two, three out stations. There was a mission hospital at a place called Bafut, which is quite out in the grasslands, to the north of the main town there called Bamenda. And Bamenda was the sort of the regional town, if you see what I mean. And we'd fly from Mamfe or from Tiko, which also had an airfield, with our equipment, and we'd fly to Bamenda, for instance.
Now, how do you spell that?
Bamenda.
B-A-M-E?
Bamenda, Bamenda. And we'd fly to, and it was just a laterite airstrip, you know, rolled out. Engineers had put matting down and that was it, and we had several of these places where you go, and that journey would take probably an hour and a half, whereas it'd take you all day by road. So if we'd plan a course of treatment and visit from Tiko to Kumba, which was in the middle. Kumba and Mamfe were pretty close together, and then we'd fly from Mamfe to Bamenda, and from Bamenda back to Tiko to save time.
And what would you do on each landing? So you land, say, at Bamenda. What would you do?
Right, you landed at Bamenda. There's no airport built or anything like that. It's just a strip, and there'd be a truck there to meet you, because the radio ahead that we were coming, and we'd be picked up by a truck at the airfield, and we'd be taken to the base, the camp at Bamenda. We'd set up shop in the medical reception station, or the MI room, and do a couple of days' treatment.
So you'd stay there for a day or two?
Oh, yeah. Stay for two, 3 days and do the local dental treatment. We might have one operating session if there was any of the more surgical specialised things to do. We quite often visited the mission hospital and helped them.
Now, what would a typical visit to a mission hospital be like? Because that's operating with the African civilians, isn't it?
African civilians, yeah. Well, they suffered badly. They needed quite a lot of treatment from the point of view of hygiene treatment, and advice on oral hygiene, that sort of thing. So I'd set up a classroom with my dummies and give them a lecture on oral hygiene and so on. I used to help the local radiographer in one place because his equipment was so old, and we had quite modern equipment with easy disposable packets of chemicals for his dark room and so forth. So I'd mix him up a couple of batches of his chemicals for his dark room, sort of gratis from the army, and do a few pictures with him to prove it was all right. And that was him off and running, and do a few talks to the African natives, as I say, on oral hygiene and so on.
Through a translator or...?
No, they spoke English. Not very good English. It was quite peculiar. It was a Victorian-type English. But they understood what I was saying to them.
Now, what level of oral hygiene are you talking about? What do you mean by oral hygiene as far as...
Well, how to use mouthwashes, keep the mouth clean, soft tissues clean, what to look for in the case of herpes, mouth ulcers, that sort of thing.
So not just teeth, it was...
Just the general hygiene of the mouth and the throat, the esophagus. And teach them, of course, how to clean their teeth properly and how to use toothbrushes and so on.
Well, would they have those?
They had their own version, which is sort of chewed bamboo that they scrub their teeth with, but you introduce them to the famous Oral-B. You've heard the Oral-B toothbrush. They were around even then. And we take a quantity of these and teach the children how to use toothpaste and that. You're a general sort of health service, if you like. And we'd go in, the mission nuns and doctors and that would give us a room, and I'd set up shop and do a bit of oral hygiene.
And how long would you be out? I mean, would you go from outstation to outstation, or would you go back always to Mafi?
No, you stayed at the outstations. If you went up country, for instance, to Bafut, they'd accommodate you in what they call their holiday, their visitor bungalow, which is a little concrete-type house with a couple of beds and mozzie nets in, and you stayed the night there. Then you drove back the next day. Cause night comes very quickly in Africa. It's light 1 minute and dark the next. And it's not healthy to travel in the dark, especially when some of the locals are not locals and they're there for mischief. So you'd stay with them for the night. Because we had our own portable food preparation and so forth. Take that with you, the iron rations. Compost is called.
Was it compo? I was going to ask about food out there. Tell us about the food you got out there, Jen. Firstly, compo.
Compo was the 10 and 5-man ration packs, which are quite extensive, and in the hands of a good chef, you make a good menu from them. We used a lot of compo. Our main diet was compo. And from time to time, we had, of course, the Nafi ship supply coming in from Nigeria. And they brought in fresh vegetables, potatoes, that sort of thing. And we would be eked out with what we could buy locally, which wasn't much. You could buy eggs and chickens locally. But the African cattle have got no flesh on them at all, so it's pointless buying them. The butcher couldn't do anything with them, you know. So we used tinned meat and as much fresh vegetables as we could get. But there was quite a lot of these dehydrated vegetables.
English vegetables?
Oh, yeah, they came with the compo. 7-pound khaki tins of dried everything. Cauliflower, cabbage, peas.
Did you eat local vegetables and produce, things like beans?
Not really. It was frowned upon. Because their hygiene and what they feed the vegetables on isn't very nice.
And how were you with this diet?
All right. I mean, you didn't get fat, but you didn't starve either.
And how was your health generally, your health?
Very good, apart from skin disorders.
Now, what problems did you get with that?
Well, this is caused by the heat. I mean, you'd get Dolby itch and so on, which is caused by sweat rash, in other words, which is caused by the type of uniforms and the way they washed. I mean, the African houseboys, you'd take them down the river and beat them to death on the rocks, you know, and bring them back, iron them with a big charcoal iron, charcoal powered steam iron, and then you put them back on again. But they starch everything, even your underpants, which is not very healthy, I can assure you. So that sort of thing you suffered with. And you've got quite a lot of you've got quite a lot of foot termites, that sort of thing. You've got to be very careful when you did.
Verrucas or different types.
No, foot termites, actually things that burrow into your feet. They're quite rife there. And of course, if you went on jungle patrol with the boys as medical cover, you got leeches. The firm practices you wear French leather, so the leech doesn't get up the end of your old man.
That you genuinely did that.
Oh yeah.
What about dysentery or upset?
You always had jelly belly. I mean, that's an occupational hazard in these climates. Would you kept a large bottle of Miss Diabolical handy, and took a dose of Jollop every time you got the old trots.
But it wasn't actually dysentery, No. It was diarrhea.
Yeah, just jelly belly, you know. Chippy tummy.
These patrols, would you go on them often?
Yeah, once a month, twice a month.
And what were they like? Take us through what a typical patrol was like.
Well, they had to...
Who were you accompanying first?
Well, the infantry battalion, the King's Own Royal Border Regiment, they'd have to take a medical orderly with them to do general medical treatment. And they'd go up country and through the villages, because they were always on the hunt for insurgents coming in from over the borders, because our principal role there was to keep the peace whilst they decided on this plebiscite as to who they were going to join, whether they were going to become a republic on their own or whether they were going to join the Nigeria complex, which was becoming independent, because in early 1960 Nigeria became independent. It was now a sovereign state. And our boys just have to patrol, road patrols, along the jungle tracks to the villages and make sure that there wasn't any agitators and troublemakers.
Now, what do you remember of those? Take me through a typical patrol as you remember it.
Well, I patrolled out of Kumba, which is more or less in the middle area of, and you're virtually straight out of the village and into the jungle. And we used to go along about 10, 15 miles and visit two or three villages. And you watch a typical patrol. You were in patrol order. You walk along. With
What's patrol order?
Patrol order is one behind the other with outriders, so that if there's any problems, your outriders hit the problems first and relay back to the main body. Then you have tail end Charlie behind you to make sure nobody's behind you.
And people would be armed with?
They were armed with the standard issue Sterling machine gun, hand grenades. Officers had pistols.
And Lee Enfields.
Sorry?
Lee Enfields, were they used rifles?
No, they weren't Lee Enfields.
It was submachine guns.
And we had the Belgian FN in those days.
Which
the SLR, self-loading rifle.
That had come in, had it?
Well, that had come in, yes. There was the early days of the self-loading rifle. So you had Sterlings or the SLR, which also gave you also, you see, the GPMG, the General Purpose Machine Gun, which was a 7.62, and pistols, Browning pistols.
And what was the jungle like? We haven't really talked about that, so it's a good time. What was it like? There's many different types of jungle.
The tropical rainforest is, as it's described, tropical rainforest. It's very wet. The undergrowth is very thick. The trees are colossally high, with the canopy way up. In fact, when it's humid to the point where you've got the steam rising up off the undergrowth, you can't really see the canopy. It's sort of a steamy, distant green foliage, if you like. And there's all sorts of liana and tropical grass and undergrowth along the path. You use a panga to cut your way through it.
That's
chopping machete, yeah. In places, you've got to chop your way through because there isn't a path. The path gets overgrown within days. You'll cut a path today and come back a week later, and it's overgrown, it's disappeared. So it's prolific growth is the tropical rainforest. And of course, there's everything crawling and creeping and gibbering and imaginable. There's millions of butterflies and insects and so forth all the time.
Now, take us, what were they like, these insects? I mean, what were the nuisance ones, firstly?
Well, the nuisance ones, of course, was our friend the mosquito. You always get those biting type insects, of which there's myriads of variety of biting insects. And of course, you've got to be careful of ants in the jungle because the ants are in columns and they're vicious. If you get covered in ants, you've got problems, you know, if you step into one of the streams of ants. So you keep on the watch out for all these sort of things as you're going along. And you get lots of flying insects. And of course, you get the jungle leeches that live on the bushes, and they'll just fall onto you and latch on. And snakes, of millions of different varieties of snakes in the rainforest. And frogs, thousands and thousands of frogs. And they all have a chorus, they're all going all the time.
Were you frightened of the various snakes? I mean, did you know whether they were dangerous or not?
I was wary of them, yeah. You just don't make acquaintance with them if you can possibly avoid it. But they're more frightened of you than you are of them. I mean, if they hear you coming, they will go in the opposite direction. The only time you have a contretemps with a snake is when you actually stand on it, or you meet it in a place where it can't escape. So really, I mean, they don't attack you or anything like that. As I said, they're more wary of you than you are of them.
So you'd be going into the jungle, and what would happen? Well, any time you're patrolling through, what happens?
Well, the out station would sight someone, or someone or persons unknown, advancing on you, and you would take action accordingly until they'd come up, advanced, being recognised, and then pass on down on their way merrily, you know. There was an awful lot of smuggling went on.
Now, how would you check someone? I mean, they don't exactly have documentation, I presume. I mean, so what was the procedure?
Well, the person would be challenged and would stop. If they had a head bundle, it was usual to look in the head bundle, see if they weren't transporting things like drugs, ammunition, offensive weapons, because these were forbidden. And then you'd let them go on their way.
And did you ever find any on a patrol, anything significant?
Not on a particular...
Well, you were on, you know.
Yeah, not one of the patrols that I accompanied, no. But there was several patrols. They went to a raid with the Nigerian police to a place called the Obenigan Peninsula. And they were making bathtub gin and all sorts in this place. And they loused this whole place out. It had been supplying the locals with nasties for forever, you know. A very lucrative business for somebody.
Now, what about, did you do any village searches? Or
I only attended one, and that was only from a distance. The troops were in advance, and we just happened to be passing in the vicinity on one of our treatment visits around the different camps.
So it wasn't while you were on a patrol?
No. But they went on. I mean, they went on regularly. And the French were on the other side of the border, and they really used to go to town on theirs.
Now, can you take me through the political situation and why the riots started? I mean, because we've talked about some of it. What was going on exactly?
Well, there was a disagreement as to... There was several political parties. One of the political parties wanted independence at any cost. And that always means trouble. There was another political party that wanted to merge with Nigeria and become part of Nigeria. And they used to fly around all over the place and flying the Nigerian flag and inciting people to disagree with the local order, law and order, and so forth. And then there was the other faction that wanted to become a Cameroon Republic and join with the French over the border and become a republic. And these were the dodgy ones because they were influenced from the outside by the rebel-type people the insurgents from the Belgian Congo and the surrounding states, where they were at it big style. I mean, they murdered whole villages and so forth. You've heard of the Katanga province. Well, Patrice Lumumba and his Murray men, they were a real nasty bunch. And occasionally you'd come across them, because they'd be out trying to incite our people, who are more or less peace-loving, into riot. And it'd come to blows quite often, and we'd have to do riot control and so forth and sort them out.